quite a crowd for such a lovely day outside. Good to see you all. As I was walking in, I realized that the lake hasn't broken up yet. I was kind of surprised. I thought I was here a couple days ago and still had some ice on it, but I thought yesterday would have wiped it clean. But it's way ahead of itself, regardless, because of the weather. The title of my talk today is Peace, Justice, and the Vow to Free All Beings. Recently, we at the Zen Center were contacted by an organizer from out front Minnesota. He was inquiring whether or not we wanted to join Minnesota United's Minnesota United for All Families Coalition. It's a coalition of about 200 organizations throughout the state, over 200 organizations, businesses, governmental bodies, nonprofits, and over 40 faith organizations. The coalition is organized against passage of the marriage amendment, constitutional amendment, that'll be on next fall's ballot. It's an amendment that states that marriage is solely a union of one man and one woman. Some people, we already have a law in the state to that effect, but some people feel that more is needed and that that amendment is necessary to maintain the values of our society. The coalition views it as discriminating against the minority for the first time in our Constitution. Shortly after that, I was contacted by people from Clouds and Water Zen Center. It's a sister Zen Center in St. Paul. And they were organizing an effort to get Clouds and Water to join that coalition by educating their community and talking with the board of directors. A few months ago, after tea, or during tea, Tim brought a young man over to me with whom he was talking, who was really interested in getting the Zen Center to sign on against the amendment. And Tim said, "Hey, why don't you talk to Lee?" I'll come back to the marriage amendment in a bit, but that all got me thinking about what, if anything, we as a community should do in this matter. It also got me thinking about a bigger question. What is the role of spiritual and religious communities in politics, social discourse on public policy, taxes, spending? Should religious communities take stands on issues like racism, poverty, homelessness, environmental destruction, sexism, or homophobia? How should spiritual communities engage, if at all, in the dirty world of politics? The world of politics is all about conflict and ego. That's how it operates. How do we as Buddhists engage while maintaining our commitment to equanimity and no self? It can be intimidating and stressful. Many people feel they should attain equanimity and peace before they take on worldly issues. Now, we Zen and Mahayana Buddhists have a vow to save all beings. It is the vow. It's the big vow. It's the Bodhisattva vow. Compassion and wisdom are two organizing principles of our tradition, our Zen tradition. Is public policy and politics relevant to that vow? Homelessness, poverty, racial injustice, these are systemic issues that call for systemic responses. Do we have any moral obligation to do something about them? The great Abrahamic traditions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, have strong injunctions regarding one's responsibility to others and to social justice, more so than our Buddhist tradition does. And in fact, there are many interfaith organizations that enter the political fray on issues like poverty, racism, destruction of the environment, women's rights. Right here in the Twin Cities, there are several groups. There's one called Isaiah. It's a network of 90 congregations that strives, in their words, quote, to transform experience of despair, scarcity, and fear with a stirring vision of community, hope, and God's abundance providing for all people, end quote. On their homepage, they have a quote from the book of Isaiah. You shall be called a repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to live in, end quote. And their tagline under Isaiah is building just communities in Minneapolis, St. Cloud, and the St. Paul regions of Minnesota. So there's a faith organization that thinks it is relevant to be involved in issues of politics and policy. There's another group called the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition that focuses on poverty and taxes at the legislature. It has over 60 Jewish, Christian, and Islamic communities, faith communities, and organizations as members, as well as hundreds of individuals. So they understand the connection between poverty and taxes. Now, quite frankly, we in the Zen tradition don't have a good record in this area, especially in the 20th century in Japan. A guy by the name of Brian Victoria wrote a book called Zen at War, and it documents Zen's incorporation into the Japanese war machine leading up to World War II. So Zen is oftentimes viewed as a peaceful, Buddhism is viewed as peaceful and non-warlike. Pull back the screen, then we find something else. On the cover of this book is a picture of monks at Eihei Monastery is the mother monastery, if you will, of our Soto tradition. And these monks are in their robes, marching with bayonets. Victoria writes, quote, in my 25-year search for the answers to the question, what is or what should be the relationship of the Zen Buddhist priest, he is a Zen Buddhist priest, to society and its members, to the state, to warfare, and to politics and social activism. And he goes on. The ideas and people I encountered in the subterranean realm of Buddhism were the exact inverse of those on the surface. Down below, warfare and killing were described as manifestations of Buddhist compassion. The selflessness of Zen meant absolute and unquestioning submission to the will and dictates of the emperor. And the purpose of religion was to preserve the state and punish any country or person who dared interfere with the right of self-aggrandizement. And he goes on to name the authors who wrote some pretty terrible things, many of them highly regarded transmitters of Zen to the West. Names like D.T. Suzuki, Harada Sogaku, Saku Soen, Zen masters, Japanese Zen masters, who were highly influential in the transmission to the first generation of American Zen teachers. These were Zen masters who embraced militarism, war, racism, and over-the-top devotion to country. Now that all makes me really quite uncomfortable. Beyond the example of religions gone amok, history is littered with religious wars. Millions of people killed for religious reasons. The Middle East today is just the most recent iteration of that. And I think the fundamentalism that is so divisive in the Middle East, the religious fundamentalism that's so divisive there, is not dissimilar to some of the religious fundamentalism that is reflected in our current presidential primary. It's all very troubling to me. And then we Buddhists have this vow, the bodhisattva vow. We recite it daily. We vow to save all beings. So in this context, what does that mean? Well, it starts with the first noble truth. Suffering exists. We vow to free all beings from suffering. The second noble truth, that there is a cause of suffering. This cause is craving, thirst, clinging, grasping. We vow to free all beings from constant craving and seeking for something outside of ourselves or themselves. And we do that by cultivating great peace or original peace, manifesting eternal peace, or what's called our original face. And because everything is interconnected in our world, that manifestation then is part of the great whole. That's all we can do, really. Practice and cultivate joy and equanimity on the cushion. Manifest and expound eternal peace. It's very important to do. That's why we sit daily. That's why we go on silent retreats. But day to day, what do we do with the suffering of homelessness, war, poverty, and hunger? Is just sitting on the cushion sufficient? I don't think so. Listen up on this one, because it's an answer to a question you asked. The Theravadan Buddhist tradition refers to the four requisites for monks. They are food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. Food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. Lay people in that tradition give those things, those requisites, to monks who are not allowed to work, at least in the Theravadan tradition. In our tradition, we have a saying, the monks have a saying, a day without work is a day without eating. I mean, they're quite different traditions. And in exchange for those four requisites, the monks give dharma teaching. Now, I'm going to take that one step further and say that the four requisites are necessary before one can hear the dharma. That we Buddhists should make sure that all fellow beings have the four requisites. Those are necessary before the great peace can be attained. Though, of course, the great peace is right here, right now. Our dharmic work is to be generous with food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. As I mentioned, the Abrahamic traditions have many tenets about giving to the poor. We Buddhists don't have many, but Thich Nhat Hanh has written that if anyone has more of the four requisites than they need, and there are others who don't have enough, it's immoral. That's a call to moral and ethical action in our communities. So how does our vow to save all beings manifest in our little MZMC community right here on the shores of Lake Calhoun? And should it manifest in any organized way? Well, I think it should, and it actually does. Here at MZMC, we have led meditation in a prison, and are joining with others to lead meditation in the Hennepin County Juvenile Detention Center in the next few months. And last year, we began a partnership with the Joyce Food Shelf to help families who are poor and can't afford the basics of life. And by the way, we have a food drive going on right now until the end of March, collecting canned goods, personal care items, and money for Joyce, and as an incentive to give, though you shouldn't need one, the Minnesota Food Share is matching every pound of food that we donate with a dollar. So Joyce Food Shelf will get that funding as well. Joyce is right here in the hood, and it provides food to 1,400 households a month. Their mission is to distribute food to those in need with respect and dignity as an expression of the love of God. So over 3 years, the last 3 years, we've made an effort here at MZMC, Minnesota Zen Medicine. I'm on the finance committee of MCEA, so I guess a little we've made an effort to be of service to the community, to those who are suffering because of poverty and lack of sustenance and and incarceration. I've been in prisons and know that they are centers of suffering that equal hospitals in our communities. They represent a concentration of people who are poor, of color, often addicted, and without basic education. I'll come back to that in a minute. But I'd like to spend the rest of my, or most of the rest of my talk, exploring Zen Buddhism and social engagement, social service, and social justice. And I'm going to use the Zen Peacemaker Order's three tenets as a framework for engaging and healing ourselves and our communities. And the Peace Order, Peacemaker's Order, has a number of precepts, but what I'm going to talk about are the three main tenets. But before that, the Peacemaker Order defines peacemaking as making whole. Peace equals wholeness. Making peace equals making whole. One way to think about this might be through the Buddha's teaching of emptiness, or no self. Nothing has a discrete identifiable self. The river in front of my house doesn't exist as a discrete entity. We call it the Mississippi River, but it's made up of water and minerals, fish and plants. It's constantly exchanging water with the air and with the soil. It rests in a watershed that is made up of soils, plants, and animals, each of which is made up of thousands of millions of elements. The river is really not a river. And that's kind of how I came to Buddhism, through an awareness of ecology and environmentalism. Now, the flip side of emptiness, or no self, is interbeing. That everything is dynamically interconnected. That is what existence is. Existence is really nothing more than that dynamic interpenetration. Thich Nhat Hanh calls it interbeing. Traditionally it's called or translated as dependent co-arising. In a similar vein, in our tradition, we talk about original face or eternal peace. This is what we cultivate and manifest in our daily meditation. We cultivate, manifest, and indeed are the unity of existence. So the concept of wholeness is not that far from this concept of great peace or original face. Dogen, the founder of our school, said as at the beginning of a 90-day retreat, "Sitting on your cushions, unconcerned by other affairs, throughout the day, silently, serenely, appreciate the great peace." He named his temple eternal or abiding peace. Now, there's a feminist social work. I'm a social worker. And there's a feminist social work concept that has helped me with this idea of peace as wholeness, especially in the realm of conflict, be it political, personal, or social. The principle is one of eliminating false dichotomies. What that means is avoiding the trap of win-lose, or right-wrong, your position, my position, and seeing beyond to a new and more encompassing solution. Whether in a family, a community, or a legislature, the perspective provides another way of approaching conflict that helps people get beyond holding tightly on to their own positions. Dogen wrote an essay entitled Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance. And Bodhisattva is kind of our ideal in this practice, in which he calls out identity action as one of those four methods. He writes, "Identity action means non-difference. It is non-different from self, non-difference from others." He's talking about that concept of wholeness and unity. So, making peace from the perspective of the Zen peacemaker order is the act of breaking down separateness, breaking down the idea of another. It is in opposition to fear, anger, and hatred. It's also never-ending. So now that those through the three tenets, they are penetrating the unknown, bearing witness, and healing ourselves and others. Those are the three tenets I'm going to talk about. I vow to penetrate the unknown. And why is this the first tenet of the peacemaker order? Well, by letting go of ideologies or firm positions, we become more able to respond appropriately and effectively to any given situation that comes up. We aren't responding to what we're thinking is happening, and we don't respond solely based on our thought patterns and karma. New and previously inconceivable responses and solutions become available to us. In the political realm, penetrating the unknown allows for dialogue rather than shouting the same things over and over and over again. If you don't know what is the one and only true truth, you can be more open to others' ideas about what is truthful. Penetrating the unknown is a very important concept in our tradition. There's a story about Fa Yen, who was the founder of one of the five traditional schools of Zen in China. And Fa Yen and a couple of his buddies were on a pilgrimage. They did a lot of pilgrimaging back in those days. And they got snowed in at this country temple. And once the weather cleared, Fa Yen and his buddies were going to take off and continue on their pilgrimage. The abbot at that country temple was Gui Chen. Gui Chen asked, "Where are you going?" Fa Yen replied, big question. It doesn't seem like it, but it's a big question. "Where are you going?" Fa Yen replied, "On an ongoing pilgrimage." Good answer. Gui Chen said, "Why do you go on pilgrimage?" Fa Yen said, "I don't know." Gui Chen said, "Not knowing is most intimate." At these words, Fa Yen instantly experienced enlightenment. Or we recite quite often during our retreats here, a poem called The Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage by Sher Dao. And here are a couple of lines from that poem. "Though the hut is small, it contains the entire world. In 10 square feet, an old man illuminates forms and their nature. Sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus this mountain monk doesn't understand at all." So that place of meditation, that place of unity, is a place of not knowing. Not knowing. The second vow of the peacemaker order is to bear witness. And one way to think of this is to really deeply be present. It's bearing witness to the wholeness of life and situations, being fully present. And part of this is bearing witness to ourselves, to the wholeness of ourselves, even the parts we often keep hidden. And sometimes when we're sitting in retreat, these parts all of a sudden come into view because we've let go of our covering them over again and again and again. So being aware of our biases and inclinations, our patterns and karma, being open to them without judgment. Being witness is basically being aware. And the opposite is denial or ignorance. When I'm leading meditation in prison, I'm just being with the offenders, without assumptions or judgment about where they've been, what they've done, who they are. Just letting them unfold as everything is unfolding in the minute, as the universe unfolds. Dong Shan was talking with his teacher. Dong Shan is the founder of our school in China. Dong Shan was talking with his teacher Yun Yan about whether insentient beings can expound the Dharma. Can rocks and walls expound the Dharma? Yun Yan said, "Haven't you seen that in the Amitabha Sutra it says the lakes and rivers, the birds and forests, they all chant Buddha. They all chant Dharma." Upon hearing this, Dong Shan experienced great insight. He then wrote this verse. How incredible. Intimate things proclaiming Dharma is inconceivable. It can't be known if the ears try to hear it. But when the eyes hear it, then it may be known. Bearing witness is hearing with the eyes and seeing with the ears. It's being totally present. And it's the beginning of making ourselves and society whole. The Zen Peacemaker Order implements bearing witness through retreats. Week-long retreats. They do one at Auschwitz to bear witness to the massive-scaled horrors that human beings are able to perpetrate. And they do week-long retreats on the streets of New York City, bearing witness to the suffering and joy of people who are often in the shadows or on the margins of our society. People who are often right in front of us, but who we don't see. Volunteering at the Joyce Food Shelf is a way to bear witness. In the early days of the AIDS epidemic, I used to just sit, just be, with 20-something-year-old men who looked like they were 85 and were dying really horrible deaths. And I could just sit. I realized I couldn't do anything. And talk about unknowing. At that time, they didn't even have a name for AIDS. I could only be there with them in their suffering and their joy. And there was both. So once we bear witness and truly listen, we have to act. And we act out of seeing things as it is. Our responses are going to be more appropriate and dynamic and effective given the situation. So the third tenet of the peace order, peacemaker's order, is to heal oneself and others. So penetrate the unknown, bear witness, and then heal oneself and others. I vow to heal myself and others. Healing action is compassionate action and arises out of bearing or penetrating the unknown and bearing witness. It's very natural. It's like reaching out for an old man who's about to fall or picking up a baby who's crying. And it's action that makes us whole and makes the universe. And it makes no sense to wait until we're pure and healthy and totally healed before we heal others. We heal others the same way and with the same actions that we heal ourselves. Through the spontaneity and appropriateness that arise out of unknowing and being fully present. Cal Appleby, who is talk about being at the Zen Center for a while. Cal's been here for decades. He still shows up occasionally. And he teaches about what he gets from working with people in prisons and nursing homes and homeless shelters, because he does meditation in those settings. And he often says, I get more than I give. It's whole and dynamic healing, and it's not something he does to someone else and he's after he's been healed. It's something that happens in the moment when he is there and he is open and he is totally present. The healing naturally arises. Another one of Dogen's four methods for the Bodhisattva is beneficial action. He says, beneficial action is to skillfully benefit all classes of sentient beings, that is, to care about their distant and near future. It is an act of oneness, benefiting self and others together. Thus you should benefit friend and enemy equally. You should benefit self and others alike. If you have this mind, even beneficial action for the sake of grasses, trees, wind, and water is spontaneous and unremitting. This is the way to make whole. This is the way to make peace. It's the way to heal. So a short summary of those, of the peacemakers, the Zen peacemakers' three precepts. Vowing to penetrate the unknown, which is our practice, deep roots in our practice. Bearing witness to joy and suffering, and then naturally out of that, healing ourselves and others. Now back to the marriage amendment. There's information about from Minnesota's United on the front porch. Please take it and read it if you're interested. There are 28 states that currently have constitutional amendments against gay marriage. And if the amendment were defeated here next fall, we would be the first state to say no to that kind of amendment. The Zen Center hasn't taken a stand on the issue. It's not one of the 40 faith communities that has joined the coalition against the amendment. But I think it would be wonderful if the amendment went down. And I think there's a piece out there as well that describes the strategy of the coalition against the amendment. And it is simply to encourage people to have conversation. Just have conversation. That's all. As I was thinking about this morning particularly, although I would love to see the amendment defeated, and I'm a gay man, marriage has never been my issue. And I've been married. I've been married, legally. And I've been with my partner for 30 years. And it's really quite amazing, because only 35 years ago, it was inconceivable of me to even think of myself as gay. It was inconceivable. And what was doubly inconceivable was that two men could have a loving, emotional, economic, physical, sexual relationship for 5 years, to say nothing of 30. It was, where I grew up, that was absolutely inconceivable. It's out of the bounds of conceivability. And when I came out, it was the height of the sexual liberation. Women's movements, a gay liberation movement. I mean, sex was something you did. A lot. And so those 4 years were quite interesting for me. And then shortly after that, AIDS appeared on the scene. and everything changed dramatically. And so when I think about having been in a union for 30 years with the same man, that was inconceivable and had that kind of environment to start in, and that it happened so quickly, that I went from inconceivability to being in a union, tells me that something is important about that kind of union to human beings. Or maybe it's just cultural, I don't know. So finally, I think it's time for people who are interested in our sanghas reaching out beyond our own walls to have some conversations about what that might look like. What might it look like to serve and work for racial, economic, and social justice from a Buddhist perspective, from a Buddhist worldview and value system? As I said, we started a prison practice and become partner with Joyce Food Shelf. Are there other ways we might be bodhisattvas? Should we engage in transforming, as Isaiah puts it, the experience of despair, scarcity, and fear with a stirring vision of community, hope, and God's abundance providing for all people? How would we do that as Buddhists? How would it deepen our practice and our sense of community? So I'm inviting members who are interested in this or exploring this to join me in a conversation about engaged Buddhism, and I don't know where it'll go. I'm going to approach it embodying the Zen Peacemaker Order's first precept, which is penetrating the unknown. There's a sign-up sheet. So out there next to the information from the coalition at Minnesota Families United Coalition is a sign-up sheet. If you're interested in exploring this a bit further, please sign up with your name legible and your email address equally legible. So that's it. Does anyone have any questions, reactions, thoughts? Why did I know you're going to pop your hand up, by the way?
Thank you so much for your healing talk, Lee. I know you will welcome this opportunity to give another talk based on what you've been saying today. I wonder if you have a response to the practice of self-immolation, which has been part of the Arab Spring and, of course, part of the Tibetan political situation as well.
Boy, that's a long... I remember when I was in high school, I went.
Yes, that's a difficult.
It is a difficult. And I'm only remembering back to when it was asked previously. I went to Boys State, Bay State Boys State. So you know, in high school, you know, you kind of like, you get to go and pretend you're legislators for a day, and I don't know, senior, junior, and I was on an elevator, and a mentor, teacher, chaperone was asking me a question, and it was the same question. I mean, and we were in a discussion, and these were frothy times, as you well remember, and he asked me the same question. And that's really all I'm going to say at this point. I mean, it deserves a discussion, yeah, an exploration. Yes,
it's interesting that you talk about this. I talked to a bunch of lawyers on Tuesday, when the Hennepin County Bar Association Board of Directors voted to adopt a resolution urging the 8,000 lawyers of the Hennepin County Bar to take action, not just simply to oppose the, what I call the anti-marriage amendment, but to actually take action to actively oppose it. And their request was that people speak to their friends and neighbors. That's all the action that they wanted them to do, but to speak up. So I find it interesting that today you talk about that, and they joined Minnesota United, which is pretty incredible for a bar association to do that.
Yeah,
just thought I'd mention that.
Thanks. Other questions or reactions? Wow.
I just wanted to say I really enjoyed your talk. And I'm glad that you brought it to the forefront, because I believe that, like you said, penetrating the unknown is kind of scary. And there's all these issues that you talked about, and it does start with a conversation. And those are topics that have normally been swept underneath the rug, and I think it's important that they talk about as well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You know, I think talking about these issues can be over, or when you try to think about what to do, it can be really overwhelming. I mean, you read, just open the paper, you know. It can be very, very overwhelming to know what to do, to know what's right action. And to some extent, I think that's why having a spiritual community that kind of talks about stuff and kind of gets a little clearer and has some sense of, in this situation, what is going to be right and truly responsive action out of a place of centeredness and equanimity. So I think to some extent that can be confusing and overwhelming. It can be. Anything else? Yeah.
Well, I wanted to say I'm really encouraged by what the potential of what we have to do as an organization. But I've also been very encouraged here, knowing the work some of our Sangha members do in the world, and like having that individual base coming from penetrating and bearing and taking action. So it's great and supportive when we can join together, but also I feel supported to go into the world with that base.
Yeah. Yep.